Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Packed program today as we touch on the issues of EB5, heroin overdoses in Barrie, and whether the Lamprey Control Program will continue after concerns were raised by the health department about the chemicals used to kill the lamprey. This is a significant issue for fisher, for people that fish our streams and waterways and our lakes. Addressing these issues today will be April Burbank, reporter from the Burlington Free Press. The paper has attempted to get emails surrounding the departure of the EB5 Economic Development Program director, and the agency has refused. They've refused to release pertinent emails, including the resignation of the director. Then Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health, will join us to discuss the recent overdoses, heroin overdoses in Barrie. And then Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Lewis Porter will join us to talk about hiccups in the lamprey eradication program. This is a major concern, and I want to emphasize this because this program has started in 2002. It has been credited with reducing the amount of lamprey attacks on fish and people who swim in our lakes as well. But first up, I want to take a moment and talk about our poll question results and wrap up our discussion about Donald Trump and the media. For the last few days, we've been taking a lot of phone calls about this issue. And the poll question was, is the press showing its bias and is it out to get Donald Trump? 31% said yes on our poll question, 63% said no, and 6% said maybe. But our telephone conversations, when you call in, possibly ran about 50-50 in terms of support that Donald Trump was getting hammered by the press, that they were showing bias, they were out to get him, and about 50% said that was nonsense. So let's sum up the many discussions we had on this issue so that we can now move on to other issues as well. This all started when Donald Trump blasted the media on Twitter last week, saying, "If the disgusting and corrupt media covered me honestly and didn't put false meaning into the words I say, I would be beating Hillary by 20%. Now, Trump was angered by media reports that were describing his campaign as in turmoil, and that advisors and family members were telling him, get focused, stay on the issues, particularly the economy, public safety, terrorism, those sort of things, and not get sidetracked on other issues. So let's sum up where we are. First, you got to acknowledge that Donald Trump's campaign is in disarray. That's kind of a fact. I mean, states that should be in contention and possible pickups for the Republican presidential nominee are swinging in favor of Hillary Clinton. And those states that are usually solid Republican and easy wins for Republican, for any Republican presidential nominee, are becoming close races between Clinton and Trump in recent polls. Here's the problem that Trump has, other than Trump. He's discovering that the rallies of his supporters aren't an indication, broad indication of his support. Now, they're support of his devoted people that come to see him. And his reliance on social media, well, that's a poor substitute for a well-established political ground game, strategic advertising, as well as real thought-out policy statements. Tweets don't equate to policy statements. And if advisors and family friends are telling them to get focused, then good for them, because they're telling them the right thing to do. And then there's this other aspect of the media that Trump realizes, but he wants it both ways. Look, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Trump craves the attention of the press, but he wants this attention on his own terms. And in a democracy, you can't have it that way. If press coverage isn't fawning or positive, then the media becomes a convenient whipping person, a scapegoat for his own failings. And here's the critical mistake that Trump made in his campaign, and this falls on Trump. Since the outset of his campaign, he's really relied heavily on the media, sometimes even doing outrageous things to get attention. But there's a problem with this strategy. It's a one-dimensional strategy that has a significant downside, because it places so much power, and Trump gave them the power, places so much power of the fate of your campaign in the hands of the media. So that's why you're hearing advisors urging him to start advertising so he can get his message out on his own terms. You know what? Trump deserves what he gets in negative media coverage. Does he deserve all of it? Probably not. Is there some piling on? Probably so. I mean, for Republicans, they will point out that studies confirm that the media as a whole tend to be more liberal than average Americans, and they're likely to closely align, at least their views, closely align with Democrats more than Republicans. And as a result, Republicans feel that there is an inherent bias in the media, and this manifests itself into an obsession with Trump, resulting, the Republicans feel, in less scrutiny of Hillary Clinton. And as evidence, what they will say, it's the media's lack of initiative in uncovering a possible conflict or questionable contacts between the U.S. State Department, headed by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the privately operated Clinton Foundation. But let's be truthful. Donald Trump makes it deliciously easy for the media to pounce on his positions because they shift. He's inarticulate oftentimes on how he explains things. He's confrontational. And honestly, he's less than transparent. But many wonder, is Hillary Clinton much better? And this is why Trump and Clinton are the two most unpopular presidential nominees in history. What a choice we have this time around. You know, this presidential election should favor a Republican nominee, especially against Hillary Clinton, who is not popular. And we've talked about this before. The American public is yearning for change. And yet, Donald Trump continues to slide in the polls, and no matter how many times he tweets, and no matter how many times he calls this election rigged, you know, the sole reason for his failure falls squarely on his shoulders, not the media. So that's wrapping up some of the things that we talked about in this week, trying to take in all your phone calls, trying to piece it all together and come up with some sense about nonsense. In a moment, April Burbank will be talking about the EB-5 program. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studios April Burbank from the Burlington Free Press. And we're going to be talking about the EB5 program. Good morning, April.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Not a lot of people know that the Agency of Commerce is actually where the EB5 program is housed in terms of the promotional aspects of the EB5 program, mm-hmm. the regional EB5 program. Mm-hmm. And it is run by an economic development director, an EB5 economic development director. That person resigned recently.
Yeah, that person was Gene Fulham. He resigned last month, and it came as a surprise. He had been on job for about a year. And it was kind of abrupt, and there was no explanation given. And, of course, this is at a time when EB-5 is under a lot of scrutiny with the allegations of fraud at the Jay Peak projects up in the Northeast Kingdom. And there's a lot of questions about the future of Vermont's EB-5 program specifically, and also how the state government has been overseeing that program and what they knew, what they should have known during this whole process.
And just to be clear, he came in about a year ago.
Yes.
So most of the investigations had started after he sort of arrived.
Yes, yeah. According to the state's timeline, I think they said they started their deep dive sometime in 2015, and that he came in July 2015, I believe. So he's been on about a year.
So you requested certain emails and public records from the agency, and what was the response?
Yeah, the Burlington Free Press requested emails, well, first of all, his resignation letter, because that was kind of getting to the heart of the question about why he left. We wanted to know what the explanation was. And then also we asked for emails between him and his supervisor, Secretary Pat Moulton, and also emails between them and the governor's office. And the response was that we got some of what we asked for. Well, first of all, it took a while to get what we asked for. There was a delay. And then we got some of what we asked for, but ultimately the kind of the heart of the request was for the resignation letter. And turns out the resignation letter actually appears to be just a 1.5-line email, and that was all redacted by the state when they responded to our request.
First of all, you were delayed in receiving the request, and you got something I've never heard of. You got a 30% discount on
discount.
Your purchase.
Yeah, it's a sale.
What was that all about?
Well, that's something I've never seen. I talked to a lawyer for the story. He'd never seen it either in a public records request. Sometimes, so the state can, you know, we deal with public records requests all the time, and the state can assess a fee on the request if it takes more than a half an hour of staff time to respond to it. So that's normal. They might waive that fee in certain cases. And in this case, they did assess a fee, but then they said, because we delayed, we're so sorry, we're going to give a 30% discount on this. So that was something that I'd never seen before, but I don't see that there's any statutory guideline for
the TJ Maxx aspect of public records requests. Let me ask about the things that were denied, mm-hmm. the Burlington Free Press. You mentioned the resignation letter, and it seemed odd to me because it was only a line and a half, mm-hmm. but it was redacted.
Yes.
And what was the reason they said?
They said it was because it was there's an exemption in the public records law called personal documents or personal records, and that applies to kind of like just like it says personal issues, kind of intimate details or things that relate to the person's employment or discipline. And so a resignation letter may fall into that exemption, but it's not necessarily. It really depends, I think, on the case. And so we've appealed it. We're going to see where that goes. It's possible we won't ever be able to see this resignation letter, but we're working on it, and I think it's up to us to do due diligence on this.
And the courts in the past have ruled, they've been pretty liberal on this, in that you really have to have something pertinent in there that discuss your personal life in order
right.
to sort of redact that information. I bet if you're just looking at the line and a half, it basically says I resign effective such and such, and it seems to me a fight. Why have this fight?
Well, I think in their view, this is something that's in the personnel file that relates to employment. I don't think that they're necessarily. I don't know what's in the email, so it's hard for me to say why exactly they chose to use this particular exemption. So I don't know. I mean, it's true. When we get the response, if we ever get to see this, it might just be a very simple, terse email with no details about what's going on. But it's worth a try.
What else did they release and not release?
So they did release emails, and actually we're still waiting for a few of them, but they released some emails between Mr. Fulham and Secretary Moulton from that month. There were some interesting tidbits, but nothing really that shows a lot of tension or turmoil or anything like that leading up to this date. And then they also denied the records between these two officials and the governor's office, citing executive privilege. The governor kind of has a broad exemption from the public records law.
This whole resignation seems odd because usually when you get a resignation of a top official, the secretary will say, it is, you know, such a loss. We're sorry to see this person go. We wish that person much future success. In this case, it seemed when this person resigned, it seemed like Secretary Moulton, she didn't say this, but the body language, the words basically said, don't let the door hit you in the rear end on the way out. Did the press get that same impression?
Well, I will say, at least in my interactions with her, that it was there wasn't much interest in discussing the reason, I guess I will say. In the initial conversation and interview I had with Secretary Moulton was, you know, he has resigned, effective immediately, he has moved on. And it was kind of just like, okay, well, that's what happened. And there wasn't much of that kind of flowery language that you talked about. So, again, we don't really know what's going on behind the scenes here. It could be a number of things, but it was unusual to see that.
What is happening now with the EB-5 director program? Have they hired someone new?
They have not. So my understanding, according to the governor's announcements and also talking to some people in the agency, is that the EB-5 responsibilities are now under the workload of the Economic Development Commission, Joan Goldstein. So they're kind of being folded into her responsibilities rather than hiring someone new specifically to work on the EB-5 program like they have in the past. And the state assures me that this will not mean any, you know, less focus or attention on the EB-5 program just because they don't have a full-time dedicated employee to it. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But it will be interesting to see going into the fall. There's a question in Congress about whether Congress will reauthorize this. This is a federal investment program. And so that's kind of the backdrop to this whole thing. We'll have to see if the program even exists after a few months, and if so, how the state chooses to deal with that going into new administration.
And why this is important is that because Vermont is a regional center for the EB-5 program. Mm-hmm. And so as a regional center, it has certain amenities that come with it. Is that right?
Yeah, Vermont is one of two state-owned or state-run regional centers for the EB-5 program. It's kind of a unique situation across the country. And Vermont has touted that as an advantage, that we have this state oversight, regulation, people are looking out for these projects, in addition to promoting them, also regulating them. And so it is a unique situation, and it's one that puts some responsibility on the state government to be accountable for the way that they've handled this program.
This is one of many intriguing storylines dealing with the EB-5 mm-hmm. program, April. But I'm going to bait and switch you here. want to talk about the primaries, because you did a lot of work on the primaries.
I did.
What's astonishing to me is the money that's been spent, $5.3 million in the primary. One of the things that you did was an analysis of Sue Minter and Phil Scott's campaign contributions. What did you find?
Well, I found that there were some interesting trends here. Phil Scott, as you might know, it has a lot of support from Vermonters and from Vermont small businesses. He took many donations from Vermont small businesses and other corporations. Sue Minter had rejected corporate contributions during the primary under pressure from her Democratic rivals. So, first of all, the biggest difference is that Phil Scott had, I think, something like a third of his contributions came from businesses, whereas Sue Minter was almost all individuals. And because of that, Phil Scott had a lot of very heavily Vermont support. Sue Minter had a mix of, I don't remember what the percentages were, but a mix of, you know, some Vermont support, some from out of state. And so that kind of played out in those ways, too, because Phil Scott was able to raise a lot of money in state.
And what do we – when they talk about their contributions, what do they say about them?
Phil Scott, I mean, I haven't talked to him about this recently, but in terms of the accepting donations from businesses, he doesn't see any issue with that. He's happy to have their support. Suminder had said that this was a kind of had followed this idea of rejecting corporate contributions as kind of an ethical or transparency move. So I haven't talked to them about their contributions recently, but that's what they've said in the past.
April Burbank, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you. April Burbank, reporter for the Burlington Free Press. You can read her article on the EB-5 program and the email controversy or the refusal of the agency to release pertinent emails in today's Burlington Free Press. Coming up, Dr. Harry Channon will be talking about the heroin overdoses in Barrie. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to our program today Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health. Good morning, Dr. Chen.
Good morning, Mike.
Dr. Chen, what's the latest update on what is going on in Barrie with the heroin overdoses?
Well, Mike, I don't have a lot of really granular detail on Barrie, but what I do know is, that there was a serious uptick in the number of overdoses over last weekend. I mean, they saw 10 in the 60 hours through the weekend. We averaged somewhere between 1 and 2 a day in Vermont. So clearly there was something going on. We, based on that, put out a press release to try to get the word out on the street about potentially a deadly strain of, of heroin that would be likely mixed with fentanyl. We've seen this several times before. It's been seen throughout our country where there will be this rash of increased overdoses, and oftentimes it's related to having fentanyl mixed in. You know, fentanyl is a powder, just looks just like heroin, and is 50 times stronger, so you never really know what you're getting.
And, Dr. Chen, is this added to the heroin, or is it in substitute of the heroin?
It's really both. I mean, I was at a meeting yesterday in D.C., and individuals were really speaking that you can, with about $500 worth of chemicals, make fentanyl and some of its analogs, and you could sell it, obviously, for an incredible markup on the street. And so it's mixed. Some of it's mixed in. Some of it's hopefully not too much of it pure, because that would really be a deadly combination.
And what happens, Dr. Chen, is that the person doesn't recognize that this additional fentanyl is added to the heroin and uses a dose that puts them in some sort of overdose, puts them in an overdose mode, right?
Absolutely. So there's no, as you might imagine, there's very little or no quality control or potency control or dosing control for people who are buying drugs on the street. So that's so clearly what we saw this past weekend in Barrie, and actually also one in Northeast Kingdom, represents a very potent batch, and people were overdosing on it and requiring naloxone and sometimes in more than one dose to reverse them.
Is this, you mentioned that it's in the Barrie area and the Northeast Kingdom this past weekend, but is this a statewide problem?
Well, at different points in time, it's been a statewide problem, absolutely. So it really just depends on who comes up with what drugs and what's in those drugs, how quickly they're distributed, and how people use them. So we have to really prepare to a large extent for the worst. And so that's why we have our naloxone program out there distributing, thousands of doses of naloxone. That's why this past week we want to ensure that the centers that distribute them up in the Northeast Kingdom and in Central Vermont had adequate supplies to get them out there.
And can you explain what that does?
Well, this is one of our major responses to the opioid overdose epidemic, and that's a drug called naloxone. It's a drug that literally reverses the effects of opioids. So when you, it was traditionally used in hospitals, so I used it a lot in an emergency department, but we figured out that now we needed to get it further away from the healthcare system. So started off in ambulances, then it went to police, And now we're really talking about bystanders and individuals who are actually using drugs themselves. And it works within seconds to a minute. It wakes people up, and it's it really is a life-saving drug. And we've distributed thousands of doses of that. So as an example, this past quarter, we distributed about 2,000 doses. And we do it at needle and syringe exchanges throughout the state to obviously get it to the appropriate population. We do it at recovery centers. We do it at treatment hubs where they're using methadone or buprenorphine. And then, you know, we're looking at creative ways to do it even more broadly.
We're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health, and we're talking about heroin overdoses, particularly this weekend that happened in Barrie, but generally the topic of heroin overdoses, and drug addiction. Dr. Chen, why the proliferation of heroin in Vermont? Is there something particular about heroin that is appealing to people?
Well, I think really what we're looking at is we're looking at the opioid epidemic, and more broadly just substance use disorder. But really, heroin has the same effect as fentanyl, has the same effect as OxyContin, and all opioids. And so you could be addicted to one, and you're really addicted to any of those drugs will satisfy your cravings and prevent you from going into withdrawal. So they're really essentially the same to an individual who is dependent or addicted. And so some of it comes down to economics, right? If you can buy, and for a while the drug of choice might have been OxyContins, but as the supply gets smaller, they cost a lot. And so now, you know, do you pay $75 for OxyContin or do you pay $20 for a bag of heroin? And then the economics are even more concerning when you could actually buy that $20 bag of heroin down in New York for $5.
Let me ask this. Where's the supply coming from?
Well, I think a lot of it generally is coming from, you know, New York and down in Massachusetts, as far as I know. The last looked, I'm not, as you might expect, that's really a public safety issue more than a health issue. The health issue is really to be comprehensive in terms of naloxone and treatment and prevention education.
So let me ask this on sort of the health side of things. Why are these so highly addictive?
Well, they're basically powerful drugs that occupy receptor sites in the brain that that provide both pain relief and euphoria. They're just occupying these sites, and the pharmacology and the brain chemistry just makes them very addictive. And you just need to keep using them to have that pleasurable sensation.
And if you're addicted, how do you kick the habit?
Well, I mean, you know, there's the classic cold turkey method, right? Where you're deathly, well, deathly is probably not an appropriate term. You feel deathly ill for a matter of days, and then you're really done in terms of the actual acute withdrawal. But then you still might have the cravings, and you still might have your environment, which really promotes people for using one substance or another to, quote-unquote, relieve their pain. So that's one way. And the other way to deal with it is what we call medication-assisted therapy, which is really acknowledging that addiction is a chronic disease, and that you're really having medication replace their opiates, whether it be methadone or buprenorphine. We have a new drug that we're trying to promote, which is called naltrexone, which actually, rather than replacing the opioids, it's actually blocking the opioids. So it's a once-a-month shot, it prevents the effects of opioids if you happen to use them.
We're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health, and we're talking about drug addiction. And this is in light of what happened over the weekend in Barrie, where there were multiple cases of heroin overdose, mostly because of laced heroin that made it much more powerful and much more dangerous over in this regard. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Paul Ian Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Dr. Chen.
Good morning.
First of all, I apologize, Mike, for taking this a little bit off topic, but it's only the opportunity I've had to speak to Dr. Chen. Last year, Dr. Chen, my wife was a participant in the philosophical exemption debate that went on. And to be perfectly honest with you, after talking to her and hearing from other people, I left with a feeling of disgust from you, the Department of Health, and politicians because of the way you treated people who were proponents of the philosophical exemption.
Let me ask this. What is philosophical exemption?
It's an opportunity for people, because of held beliefs, to exempt themselves from some, if not all, of immunization that are required by the state or the federal government.
Got it.
But in that particular case, the people had reasons for their beliefs and were basically insulted and denigrated during the process by both Dr. Chen and the Department of Health and the politicians. On top of that, we found out later in the year that there were four separate incidents around the country of people in college who were fully immunized to mumps actually coming down with the mumps. So it puts into some debate whether or not the claims by the Department of Health are actually accurate. More importantly, just recently, your Department of Health and you had to be sued in order to release information regarding tuberculosis among immigrants here in the state of Vermont. Why at this point, my question is, should I have any faith that you are actually looking out for me, my family, and others? Because it seems to me that you're kind of one-sided, not listening, closed-minded to anybody who doesn't agree with you to the point where you had to be threatened with a lawsuit just to get information that should have been released.
Let's give Dr. Chen a chance to... First, let's talk about the vaccination issue. There have been great debates about vaccination, Dr. Chen. What's the position of the health department?
Well, I think that vaccinations are really one of the 10 greatest advances in public health in terms of preventing disease, preventing death and disability in the U.S. and throughout this world. And we've eradicated disease over the years. And I think that Paul's point really highlights the challenges of it, because if we are totally going to make a decision that an individual should have a choice in the matter, then the personal belief exemption is something that obviously people are very passionate about. But on the other hand, when Paul's child goes to school unvaccinated and goes and sits in a classroom with Sally's child, who actually may have cancer or may have an immunosuppressive disease, that disease that can be transmitted can actually be deadly. So what we try to do with vaccinations and our requirements is actually to try to create enough of a critical mass of immunity to both protect those that can't be vaccinated or protect those that haven't been vaccinated. So it's a numbers game, and it's a game that protects the greatest number while understanding the challenges to an individual. And it's in terms of Paul's children, certainly there are medical exemptions. There continues to be a religious exemption, but we really need in Vermont to get our immunization rates up to protect the overall population.
Did we kind of curtail the exemptions during the last legislative session or legislative session before there? Were there more exemptions and we sort of tightened the reason you could have an exemption, or was there some legislation? I'm just trying to remember, Dr.
Right. So in terms of the progression, the first time we actually dealt with the issue, we actually put up some education requirements for the personal belief exemption. But then not last year, but the year before, the legislature and the medical community and the public health community really came together to remove the personal belief exemption. This will become effective this fall, and we expect that we know that the vaccination rates in our schools, in our children will increase, thereby protecting more Vermonters from vaccine-preventable diseases that can cause disability and even death.
I want to get back to drug addiction, but I do want to make sure that I address Paul's second question, was immigration and TB data. Have you withheld TB data?
We have not withheld TB data. There are reasons to withhold data, especially data that could be personally identifiable, but we've been providing the data in terms of the number of
Vermonters who have TB, the cases that are in refugees or immigrants. We have a very low rate of tuberculosis in Vermont. The rate is higher on foreign-born individuals, whether they be travelers, whether they be exchange students, or whether they be immigrants or refugees. I do think that we have a significant public health infrastructure in Vermont that can protect all Vermonters, whether they're born in the U.S. or not. Really, that's the bottom line for me. I don't feel that there's a significant public health risk related to immigrants or refugees, provided that they have the appropriate screening. And there is a significant level of screening, both for refugees in terms of health screening in their country before they come, and in the U.S. after they come.
We're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health, and when we come back, we'll return to the issue of drug addiction. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health. Commissioner Chen, what have we been making progress in stemming the tide of drugs and addiction in Vermont?
Well, Mike, that's a question I ask myself all the time. And I think to a large extent, it's always more complicated than that. So, some of the areas we've made progress, clearly in terms of getting more and more Vermonters into treatment, in terms of having a plan to actually try to address the waiting lists. When I go away from Vermont and talk about how we've created our hub and spoke system for medication assisted treatment, people, their jaws drop, because they can see that we can do things on a scale in Vermont that that many other states can't do. So I'm certainly gratified by our progress there. But at the same time, though, another sign of progress is that for the first time since I've been commissioner, we've actually seen a reduction in the number of opiates prescribed by Vermont prescribers. So to me, that's a start. We're actually putting together some regulations to kind of really dial back on the number of pills that might be sitting in drug cabinets, and then working with Vermonters to roll out a statewide disposal system. So I think we're making progress there. We have more progress to make in terms of changing the culture, both of prescribing, changing the culture about what you do with those excess drugs after they're done, and then ultimately reducing the stigma associated with the chronic disease of opioid use disorder. We're seeing some progress in kids, meaning the number of young Vermonters that are misusing or using inappropriately substances like prescription drugs, and they've been continuing to go down. So there are certainly areas where I'm seeing progress. But at the same time, when we're confronted with 10 overdoses in Barrie and one in Newport over last weekend, you have to kind of ask yourself, we're not there yet. And there are ways that we can both increase the use of naloxone, increase the availability of treatment. But in the end, we're going to have to look really upstream in terms of what is it that causes people to look to self-medicate for their pain. And pain is a lot of different kind of things to many different people. But that's a really bigger, broader question about creating safe, healthy, and productive communities all throughout Vermont.
John, I'm going to go to this one phone call from Linda from Waterbury. And Linda, I would ask you if you could just get to the question, because we're starting to run out of time here. Linda from Waterbury, you're on Open Mic.
Oh, hi. Hi, Dr. Chen. I think you were just leading right to my question. I think you're doing all the right things for the immediate opioid crisis. But I'm thinking that before that, there has to be a lot more access for mental health providers, because I know from experience, both personal and my professional experience, that it takes people way too long to have access to any kind of mental health when they're depressed, when they're anxious, when they're bipolar, when they're psychotic. By the time, it's often 6 months to until they can get an appointment.
So let me sort of, Linda, because of time, I just want to sort of get to Dr. Chen's answer. And I
that is the question: is why? How can we improve access ahead of time to mental health care?
And Dr. Chen, I want to get to one more question on Lamprey before we close up. So if you could just
I think Linda's absolutely right. I think we have an important outcome of all of this discussion on opioids are really the fact that we need to really have integration of what mental health, physical health, substance abuse. They all need to be put together because they're all integral to the health of each and every Vermonter, and you can't separate them in silos.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Lewis Porter, who's the Commissioner of Vermont Fish and Wildlife. We're going to be talking about Lamprey, and in the news, there's some apprehension coming from the Health Department over the chemicals used in the sea lamprey treatment in Vermont waters. Can you explain the concern?
Sure. So,
you've got a minute.
Okay. So over this past year, I've learned from PFOA, from Flint, that every citizen really values clean and safe water. So when there are permits for lamprecide, I have to look at the chemical, and it's we took another good look at the science underlying what I have to say, which is that there's negligible risk to human health. And the reality is that's not there. There's not good science to say that it's absolutely safe at any particular level. And so this is it's a pesticide, and the EPA does not expect it to be in drinking water. And so we changed our level, understanding that there's a ways to mitigate it, which is bottled water, which are charcoal treatment, which is switching water sources. So it's something that can be mitigated, and in my mind, based on the science available, at least the scientists that I have, should be mitigated to continue to use lamprecides. And to obviously, the governor is and I are everyone's in support of not losing the progress we've made in improving the health of the lake.
I got to stop you there. So thank you so much, Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of Health. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Mike.
Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife. And we're going to continue our conversation on lamprey treatment. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In a moment, we'll turn our attention to national issues. And on the line this morning is Victoria Jones. But first, I just want to give you a preview of what's coming up. Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Lewis Porter will join us to talk about possible hiccups in the lamprey eradication program. This is a major concern of those that fish our streams, rivers, and lakes because there seems, well, we'll ask the commissioner what progress we've made in those areas in terms of lamprey eradication. But I do want to turn to our colleague and at Talk Media News, Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning to you.
So how's this reboot going, the Trump reboot?
The Trump reboot, well, it's too early to say because we're on day one. So let's see what it's like at his first rally, what he decides to say about Hillary Clinton, what he decides to say about President Obama. Steve Bannon of Breitbart News has been a peddler of conspiracy theories about President Obama. He's a fan of the birther theory that President Obama was not born in the United States. So, it depends how far Donald Trump decides to embrace the views of Bannon.
You know, Victoria, I'd like to get your opinion because I understand the reasoning behind bringing on Kellyanne Conway. She's a GOP pollster and strategist. I don't understand the thinking behind Stephen Bannon. Do you have a theory on this?
Well, he said that he wants to be himself, and I think he felt constrained by what Paul Manafort was doing with the campaign, and he wants to sort of let rip, and whether he's going to go, whether he's going to win or whether he's going to lose, he wants to go down fighting and go down as Donald Trump, being Donald Trump, with his large rallies, which he believes are effective and are the way he got where he got. He doesn't like the teleprompter. He doesn't like having to moderate his views. And that's not what he's going to do for the rest of the campaign.
So let me ask you this as well. Is Clinton's strategy right now is just stay out of the way?
To some extent. I mean, she did make remarks at two events yesterday. She spoke about him taxing people or not taxing people, and how, you know, that the rich need taxing. She spoke about prescription drugs, and she did get some coverage in the AP and a couple of other places, but she's not getting widespread coverage for these things. But it's hard for her to get coverage with this going on. And it seems as though when he's imploding, she's sort of leaving him to get on with it.
It seems to me, as I sort of sit back and think about this, Trump and Clinton have the same strategy. Let Trump be Trump.
Yes, it does seem like that. And one of the things that she said yesterday, and I do have the quotation here, let me just find it. She said, hang on, I'm just going through my swimmer story. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump has shown us who he is. He can hire and fire anyone he wants from his campaign. They can make him read new words from a teleprompter, but he is still the same man. There is no new Donald Trump. This is it.
Let me ask you this about Hillary Clinton. It seems to me that many people are still nervous. What can be out there in terms of emails? Do you get the sense that the Hillary Clinton campaign is nervous as well as what can be out there in terms of emails?
Oh, yes. I do think they're nervous about that. And indeed, now that Reuters is reporting that the Clinton Foundation hired the security firm FireEye to examine its data systems after seeing indications they might have been hacked, I should think that they have to have concerns, most definitely.
Victoria, not a lot of people know that you do a daily sort of compilation of the news that's out there and send it out to people as a cheat sheet to people like myself. One of the things that caught my attention the other day was this NSA possible breach in terms of somebody hacking the NSA. And you sort of combine that with what the Chinese are doing, and I don't particularly know the physics involved in this, but they're putting up new technology in their satellites, quantum physics technology, where it's unhackable. Is this just a new era we're in, where the sort of the Cold War has turned into the information war?
Yeah, I think we are there. I think it's an information war. It's an information war at this point. That's exactly right.
The other thing, whenever I have you on the phone, I've got to turn overseas and talk about the UK. How's the new prime minister doing over there?
She seems to be doing okay. I mean, she's dealing with quite a lot of fairly rough issues. It is August, and so it's sort of the silly season over there, as it is in many places, including here. And so it's too early to tell. But of course, a lot of what she's been dealing with is Brexit, which looks like it may even be pushed back to 2019 at this point.
Is there anything out there that I missed that's of importance?
Well, of course, the other issue that everybody's talking about, well, there's two other issues. One is the White House designating $17 million for heroin and opioid abuse, for to help law enforcement agencies deal with the increase in that. And the other one is that everybody is talking about the U.S. swimmers that were pulled off the flight.
I was actually going to open with I was actually going to open with that today because it fascinates me. What were they doing? I mean, did they make up the story about being robbed? And if they did, why? That's the thing that's, I think, on everybody's mind with that story.
Well, nobody actually knows what happened. But we know that Ryan Lochte has changed his story, on several different points. He's changed his story. And so we know there's something up. And so they want to talk to all four of them. Now, Ryan Lochte, lucky old him, has already left the country. So the other three, it seems that the other three are still in the country. One of them may be in the country, but the two of them were trying to leave last night, and they were pulled off their flight. And so they are going to be cooperating with the Brazilian authorities, but Brazil is very upset about this. They feel like, okay, we know that Rio is crime-ridden. Nevertheless, we don't want to be impugned for things that we actually did not do.
Yeah, I found fascinating in a quote that when I was reading about this, my speculation is they were probably doing something they shouldn't have been doing, but one long-time expert of U.S.-Brazil relations said the incident is explosive because it fuels stereotypes on both sides. Americans who think Brazil is lawless, no man's land, and Brazilians who see the U.S. as a better-than-thou power with little respect for its institutions. So it certainly has mushroomed into something much more bigger than four athletes trying to make up a story here.
Yeah, this is really ballooned into an international incident at this point.
Victoria, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Coming up, we'll speak with Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, and we're going to be talking about lamprey, those pesky little suckers, I guess is what you say we can say about them. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studios Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish, the Vermont Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife. Could be a New York Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife.
No, thanks.
Lewis, thank you for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
I want to talk about an issue that seems to really arouse the attention of anglers, and that is lamprey. And one of the things that's been happening is that we've been using lampricide to eradicate lamprey and the hits that it has on fish in recent years. So can you sort of explain what we do to treat our waterways to help eradicate lamprey?
Sure. First of all, the program's really run by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We work with them. We're partners of theirs, and our biologists work with them on the program. It's really their program, so I just want to give them credit and give actually Senator Leahy credit for securing the funding to do this. Basically, what we do is monitor lamprey populations in the rivers where they spawn, and when those populations are exceeding the numbers that they ought to, we use a pesticide to kill them in the rivers, and that pesticide is administered under a significant amount of regulation and with significant care given, both for human health reasons and also of course to try to limit the number of other things that live in the river that are killed by that, what we call a non-target mortality, which is a euphemism for killing things you don't mean to be killing with the pesticide. We've gotten better at doing that and better at running the program as we've gone through the years of doing it, and we've seen some results from it.
Let me sort of back up before we get into the results here. And we're speaking with Lewis Porter, Vermont Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Why is it important to rid lamprey from our waterways?
Well, we're not really trying to rid them from the waterways. We know that's not going to happen, and we're not trying to do that. We wouldn't try to do that. What we're trying to do is manage the population, like we do for many species across the state. In fact, I dare say most of the game species, we hunt them because we care about it, want to do it. It's important for the state and for the people who do it, who love it and care about it. It's important. But we also do it to manage those populations. We manage other types of populations as well, including lamprey. And it's important to keep the population of lamprey within the acceptable limits, within the limits in which they're not harming fish, either for a fisheries perspective, lake trout and salmon primarily, but also other species as well, including lake sturgeon, which they attach to.
Yeah, those lovely fish.
They are lovely. They are lovely. I had an opportunity to go out with our biologists and net some. And put radio chips in them last year, and I can tell you just to touch and see a fish that's old, you know, 20, 30 years old or older, it's pretty incredible. They're a pretty amazing thing to see.
So how do they damage the fish population? We just talked about sturgeon. How do they damage the sturgeon or other fish?
Well, they attach to them and predate on them. They bore into them and eat them and can cause mortality and can weaken them as well. So it's pretty direct. They have a suction mouth with a bunch of rasp like teeth in it. They attach to them and eat them essentially.
Will they attach to humans?
Well, you know, I've heard stories that they've gotten on swimmers. They certainly don't bite into humans. At least I've never heard of it. I don't think it happens. I have heard stories of them attaching onto humans. I used to commercial fish in Alaska, and I actually had one attach onto my rain gear one time. It didn't bite into it, but it suctioned onto it while I was fishing.
So how did they get here? Are they indigenous to Vermont?
I knew you were going to ask this. It depends on who you ask. There's two competing schools of thought out there. It sort of depends on whether you listen to the historical record or whether you listen to the genetics, and there's a pretty hotly contested debate going on out there among the scientists, some of whom believe they're native to the lake and some who believe they're invasive. It doesn't ultimately matter all that much. We manage a lot of species that are native. We manage the populations of those species all over the place. And, you know, I in many days, especially when I'm dealing with an issue like this, I wish we lived in a wilderness in which animal populations, wildlife populations manage themselves. But the reality is that humans have an impact on virtually every part of the planet, and certainly in Vermont, and that we manage all of those populations either intentionally or by our presence. And lamprey are no different. Our management tool in this case is a little more public and maybe a little more controversial. But we manage virtually many of the populations, either directly or just by our activities.
So I was trying to find an answer there. Are they indigenous or not?
I you'd have to ask. You could get two scientists in here and have a fascinating hour-long debate on whether they are or not. Ultimately, to me, it doesn't matter. I mean, we our job is to manage these species, and that's what we do the best way we can. And whether they're native or whether they're invasive, almost doesn't. I mean, it matters. It's important because we want to know everything we can know about these species. But from a management perspective, I think that the book is still open on that.
The treatment of our waterways started, I believe it was in 2002. So we started managing the lamprey population back then. You were going to some graphs here to explain how effective it's been. Can you sort of expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, it actually even goes back earlier than 2002. That's when the current program began. But all the way back to 1990, we started an experimental program of treating some tributaries of the lake for them and kind of testing it out. Then we had another experimental program that went 90 to 97, and then we had another experimental program that went on for a little bit after that, and then we picked up the current program in 2002. So it's even been longer than that. But yeah, the results are hard to argue with when you look at the wounding rates on lake trout and salmon. In the mid 2000s, we were up near 100 wounds per 100 fish, or close to it in those two species, and we are now down between 20 and 30 wounds per 100 fish, and there's no question, I don't think, that that's due to the lamprey control program. And the more important results than wounds per fish, that's just a surrogate. The more important results are we're seeing returns of salmon to Vermont rivers from Lake Champlain that we haven't seen in decades at any rate. Of course, these populations are assisted by our hatcheries and are really held up by our hatcheries. But we're seeing returns of salmon to the rivers that we haven't seen. We're seeing salmon spawning up as far as the Huntington River. Of course, they're helped on the way back up by our and Burlington Electric's trap and truck program as well. But we are seeing salmon spawn up in the Huntington Rivers. We're seeing lake trout and salmon returns to fishermen, both charter boats and also people, you know, just privately fishing from their own boats that we haven't seen in many, many decades. And so the results are not just that our wounding rates are getting better. The results are people are catching more fish, bigger fish, better fish. The fish populations are doing better.
Are there certain fish that they will attach to?
Yeah, the primarily attached to the salmonids, so lake trout and landlocked salmon are the big ones. But they'll attach to other fish as well, including sturgeon, as I mentioned, and others as well.
And what they do is basically take the nutrients out of the fish as it's swimming along.
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much eat them while they're alive. It's basically what they do. sometimes you'll get a fish where the guts are actually coming out of it because of the lamprey wounds. So.
We're talking with Lewis Porter, Commissioner, Vermont Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We'll get to the management program in just a minute. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Lewis Porter, Vermont Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, and we're talking about lamprey and lamprey treatment. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Lewis, let's talk about how this is all coordinated, because you have Lake Champlain, for example, which has a border with New York, has a border with Canada. How do you coordinate sort of this? Because if you do it and New York doesn't do it, aren't we in the same place?
Right. Yeah, it's a great question because, of course, lamprey are pretty successful at moving to different tributaries. If their population is getting knocked down in one, they will colonize a new tributary or move to a tributary that hadn't been treated as well. So it's a great question. It's one of the great reasons that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service runs this program, and we help them. New York State helps them. If we have a number of treatments in New York State, some of our folks will go over there and help there. New York biologists will come and help us over here. And the Fish and Wildlife Service coordinates the whole process and decides what rivers get treated when. We're actually doing some work with them now to try to get those treatments aligned better and get on a better calendar schedule, so we're treating all of one quadrant of the lake in certain years, and then maybe taking a year off in between those treatments if the population warrants it. Of course, all of these are based on surveys of the streams and determinations of how many lamprey are reproducing in those streams and which ones to be treated and when. So we don't do treatments if there aren't lamprey there whose population needs to be brought down.
Is there a natural predator of the lamprey, or are they just too plain ugly to have a natural predator?
You know, I don't know if they do or not. You know, I've read a lot of historical accounts of people eating them, and lamprey pie and so on. Sometimes you see, actually, it crops up in Game of Thrones, interestingly enough. But there are historical accounts from Europe and from England of people eating them in the Middle Ages. I don't know if that was the lamprey that we call a lamprey. It may have been a different fish. And lamprey are a fish, not an eel, interestingly enough, even though they look more like an eel. But But in any case, I don't know that they have a natural predator. If they do, and you know, we're not 100% sure. And now I'm venturing into the science world of science, where my guys are probably getting their phones out right now to call me up and correct me, which they do well and on a regular basis, and I appreciate it. But I don't know if we know 100% why the population is to the level that it is now and what's caused that. My suspicion is that there's some environmental factors that we've caused, siltation of rivers, creation of big silty river deltas that probably didn't exist before we came along and started building buildings and roads, bridges. The population does need to be managed in the lake, and nobody, least of all somebody who runs an environmental agency, which my department is, wants to use pesticides, and you don't use them lightly, and you don't use them more than you need to. And we in Fish and Wildlife Service and others involved in the program make sure that that's the case.
So let's turn to that issue, lamprecide. The Health Department has said that there are some concerns with the chemical used during the treatment, and has said that they need to be convinced that it's safe and it doesn't affect drinking water. How do you do that?
Well, there's two steps to this. The first is that they have given us a and I should say off the top here that lamprecide is a little different than other chemicals, because the state in the permitting process through the Agency of Natural Resources has to represent that there is I think a negligible potential for human health impact. So it's unlike other things in that we are applying it, and the state should and is held to a high standard, a highest standard, and we should be. And when we grant those applications, when the agency gives those permits, the agency certifies that there is virtually no human health risk. So my understanding from the Health Department is that they looked back at the basic science and had some concerns about the validity and quality of it. Where my part of it comes in is when we get the number from the Health Department. So that number is that advisory number on when health drinking water advisories would go out is tenfold lower than it had been in past years. We're right now working cooperatively with everybody, including Health Department, Fish and Wildlife Service, water supply districts, Department of Environmental Conservation, many other groups to see if it's possible to do the treatment scheduled for this year under that new advisory and under that lower limit. So that's stage one. Stage two is we've asked some federal scientists to begin the process, and we're going to cooperate with them and as well health to evaluate the potential risk of this chemical, so we get a better handle on exactly what that is.
What does the advisory say, or what does it demand you that you do?
What it says is that, and this is really a Department of Environmental Conservation and agency-wide question, because we don't actually issue the permit at Fish and Wildlife Department. Obviously, we wouldn't want to be issuing a permit that we were also working on. But basically, what it says is that people will not be getting TFM, which is one of the chemicals used in their drinking water, at more than 3 parts per billion.
And what was the previous standard?
I believe it was 30 or 35.
And why the change?
Well, that's really a question for Dr. Chen, who you allowed to skate out of here. But my understanding is that they looked at the basic science and were not confident in that science, and so set this lower standard, which is essentially a standard at the level of detection.
Is this chemical used in other states?
Yes. It's used in the Midwest. Pretty extensively in the Great Lakes. I don't know about other parts.
And is this lamprey issue a problem in other states?
Yeah, it's an issue in the Great Lakes for sure. Okay. Certainly.
And is there a substitute for lamprecide?
Well, there is a substitute. They have built a weir on Morpion Stream in Quebec, which is basically a temporary barrier that goes into the river. That blocks lamprey from going up and spawning. A couple of issues with use of such a structure, and really the Fish and Wildlife Service are the experts on this, not I, but a couple of issues, as I understand it, with those structures. First of all, they're incredibly expensive to build, extremely expensive to build. Second of all, they don't work on larger rivers, and we have a number of larger tributaries in Vermont and New York. A third of all, they're probably not as effective, or may not be as effective as control. We're still examining and studying the impact of the Morpian weir, as it's called, and seeing how that works. And finally, they can have a significant impact, as you can imagine, on other species. You know, you're putting a barrier, water can go through it, but you're putting a barrier through a river and blocking access for other things.
Are there different ways to mitigate the concern of the health department, for example, giving bottled water, doing other things?
Yes. There's a couple of mitigation measures that you can do, and we're actively working on which of those we can get in place to do a treatment this year to stay on schedule. You can provide bottled water to people whose drinking water is affected. Of course, we always warn them that their drinking water may be affected, so they know when a treatment's going on. There's an extensive warning process and warning program in place to do that. You can also put a powdered activated carbon system on a water treatment plant, which essentially puts powdered activated carbon into the water, attaches to the TFM molecules, and then it's strained out before it goes in. And those are the primary approaches you can use. I mean, the best approach, the first layer, is to make sure when you're doing your treatment, you do it at the right level in the right places to avoid getting to water supplies.
Doesn't it dissipate rather rapidly?
It does, and of course, like any natural system, modeling how it dissipates and how quickly and where the wind's going to be blowing and how the water's going to be flowing and what the alkalinity is going to be is all tough. So we take a very, very conservative approach in that modeling, basically a worst-case scenario to determine where to use it and how much.
So just so and then I'll get to other questions here, and just so that I understand, what are the sign-offs that's needed in this procedure in order to use Lamprecide?
Sure. Well, there's the health department advisory sets the limit, essentially, or advises on the limit. That goes to the Department of Environmental Conservation. They issue the permit for the use of the pesticide, which is actually an agency. And then there's actually an agency permit as well, which is a threatened and endangered species permit in case any threatened and endangered species are impacted.
We're speaking with Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife. When we return, we'll talk to him about other issues, and I'm sure he would be happy to talk about other issues other than lamprey. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me this morning is Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, and we've been talking about lamprey. So where do we go from here, Lewis? What happens with all the things that are happening now? Where do we go? Are we going to have a program this year?
Yeah, we're working on cooperatively with all these groups that I've mentioned, all these organizations that I've mentioned, to work on that and to make that happen this year. And I think we'll get there. I think we will have a program this year. You know, more importantly, even than that, I think, is the fact that the state government and the federal government remain committed to this program, committed to continuing it and continuing its success from the governor all the way down to a lowly Fish and Wildlife Commissioner and beyond.
Yeah, and we're talking about – I didn't set it up right for you. We're talking about the lamprey program.
Yes, exactly. Lamprey control program. Exactly right. And so we are going to continue that program. We're committed to it. It's working. We're going to keep it going. But we also have to ensure, you know, the safety of people's drinking water, and we're committed to that as well.
We're speaking with Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, and we've been talking about lamprey, but we're going to switch to deer and bear and some other things as well. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program. If you want to call, give us a call right now. Let's go to Jack in Bridport. Jack, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Commissioner.
Morning.
What did you say the wound rate was for the lake trout and salmon?
Yeah, so at its peak, it was up around close to 100 wounds per 100 fish.
Is that 100% then?
Well, it is and it isn't, because some fish have more than one wound on them. So of a 100 fish sample, you got close to 100 wounds, and maybe a little bit lower on the salmon side and a little higher on the lake trout side at its peak. That was in the mid-2000s.
Currently,
we're down around 20 on salmon and between 20 and 30 on lake trout.
That just seems a little bit low to me. We fish this lake, I've been fishing it for 50, 60 years now. And it seems like that we find, I would estimate, maybe 50% of the fish that we catch, both lake and salmon, lake trout and salmon.
Yeah, I hear you, and that may well be true because different parts of the lake might have different populations of lamprey in them, and we're only measuring hits on fish that are between a certain size. So on lake trout, that's 21 to 25 inches, and on mm-hmm. landlocked salmon, that's 17 to 21 inches.
I see.
So both might be correct.
That you got a measurement in there.
Yeah.
One thing or another.
Yeah.
Thanks,
so
Jack.
We've noticed that the salmon are getting bigger. I love that.
So do we. So do we, Jack.
Thanks, yeah, Jack.
You're doing a good job on that part. They're coming a lot. We're catching them, 6-7 pounds there, where we never used to get one that big. And I know there's bigger ones. So.
Hey, that's music to my ears, Jack.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jack. Let's go to Norton in Orwell. Norton, you're on open mic with Commissioner Lewis Porter.
Thanks. I just have one quick question. A few years ago, I read the Fish and Wildlife mission statement, so I can't be exact on what was in it. But I believe that taking care of invasive species is part of it. And I have a question specifically about poison parsnip and what is and could be done to make that better. It's a problem for tourism, for health, needs to be controlled. I guess it's killing, other species too, native species. So I'm curious what the commissioner would do about that.
Thanks, Norton, for your phone call. First, can you explain what it is?
Sure. Poison parsnip is an invasive plant, common on roadways. It spreads a lot. It can destroy habitat and is also can cause an itching, burning on people as well. The entire Agency of Natural Resources, which is my department, Forest Parks and Recreation, and Department of Environmental Conservation, are all partners with others in trying to control invasive plants. It's a huge problem. It's going to get worse. It is getting worse. We do everything we can do to control it and to help others control it. But it's really going to have to be a team effort among all, not only state of Vermont departments, that deal with land management. I'm thinking of AOT and others as well, but also towns, private landowners, conservancies that own big chunks of land. It's a real problem. It's a threat not only to wildlife and wildlife habitat, but also to our forest industry, which is really, essential, and to regeneration of forests. It's in some cases, a human health concern, and it's really going to have to be all in on it, and I expect that this is a problem that's going to get worse as climate change impacts the state. So we're on it, but I got to tell you, we need everyone in.
Doe permits, are they going up or are they going down?
They're going up this year pretty substantially, and the reason is we had two very tough winters in a row, and we know the deer population is very, very much directed by the severity of the winter. We had two severe winters, so we issued fewer doe permits in those years. And then we had one of the mildest winters since we've been recording the winter severity index in last winter. So we know that the deer population's gone up substantially, both from people seeing them, from the mildness of the winter, and also from the number of car deer accidents we're hearing about out there. So we're increasing doe permits pretty substantially. The due date for putting in for one of those is August 26th. They're coming in pretty strong, so there's a lot of interest out there. But we're increasing them to just under 20,000 this year.
Moose permits and the population, is it going up and going down?
Moose permits are going down. We have a real problem as our partners and neighbors in New Hampshire and Maine have with moose. We're not hitting our population goals in certain parts of the state. So we're issuing fewer moose permits this year by about 40%, and really only issuing them for bulls, except in a couple of parts of the state where we are meeting those population goals. We're continuing to issue permits because the small number of permits we're issuing really isn't what's driving the population. It's other things, ticks, warm winters, other things that impact the moose population that are really setting it.
How do ticks affect the moose population? Because I've been reading that it has a pretty devastating effect on the moose
population. It can have an extremely devastating effect. We find moose carcasses with 40, 50, 60,000 ticks on them. And these are winter ticks. They're different than the deer tick. But they just drain them. They weaken them and drain them. And when they try to rub them off, they rub their fur off, and then they're exposed to the elements. And it's really sad. They also impact it greatly, of course, we suspect in calf recruitment. When they get on with them when they're young, but it's really having a significant impact on the population. We believe we're just engaging now in a big study with our partner states in northern New England to try to get a better handle on exactly what it is that's driving that population.
Bear problems. We hear more and more about bear problems. What are we doing about it?
Yeah. So one thing we're doing is something we've always done, which is getting our wardens out there working with people and our biologists working with people to make sure that they're not doing things that attract bears. The population of bears is quite strong, but we don't think that this is primarily a population issue. Something seems to be going on this year where they seem to be out of the woods and in people's backyards more. And we're trying to do a great amount of education and outreach to folks to remind them, to let them know they need to fence beehives, not leave garbage unsecured, protect compost in some cases, and do other things. But it's a little bit of a curious thing exactly what's going on. We're probably seeing close to, if not a record year, for bear complaints.
Artie, I want to get this phone call in, but Freddie from Facetown, if you could make this real fast, I want to get your call in, but we're running out of time.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. Commissioner, as far as the moose go, are you seeing any increased incidence of the Paralepos strongylus sinuosa, the brainworm? Because it's going up in the equine population, and I had a horse get it.
We are seeing. Thank you for that question. We are seeing some brainworm cases. Part of this study will be about trying to determine exactly what's driving the population. There's possible that there's a climate change effect on the brainworm. They pass through a land snail as part of their life cycle, so it's possible that warm, wet weather has an impact on that. But we are seeing some brainworm cases. Not sure if that's what's driving the population.
30 seconds. You having fun?
I'm having the best time. I'm the luckiest person in the world. Every day I get to go in and learn stuff and try to solve problems, and it's great. It's just fascinating every day.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. Lewis Porter, Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, thank you very much.
That's great to be on. Thanks.
And I also want to thank our other guest, April Burbank from the Burlington Free Press, talking about economic development, the EB-5 Economic Development Program, and the refusal of the agency to release pertinent emails. Dr. Harry Chen, talking about heroin overdoses, and also we touched briefly on the lamprey treatment controversy, and of course Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, can you believe it? WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM for Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for all your phone calls, and have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.